All right, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Fargo Podcast with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Hey, Mike, how's it going, buddy?
Good. I'm happy to be chilling out with you, Jeremiah. This episode made me feel rather cool. On a scale from A to C, it's definitely an A. And those are all the air conditioner puns I have. I've run clean out. So
yeah, there's only so many, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
A through C, that's all you got.
Especially, you know, it's April here on the East Coast. We're getting to be in that temperate, slightly warm period. The ACs have not come out in full force yet. But the end of this episode did bring up some of my most ingrained fears as a New York City denizen, which is walking by these high-rise buildings and having an air conditioner just fall on your head.
What a way to go. But you know what? You won't see it coming. It just it's going to be instantaneous.
I don't know if that makes it scarier or less scary, that statement.
Yeah. You look at that scene with the AC, and the first thing that pops your head is like, wow, is that pretty realistic? Like, is that exactly how it looked? Because that looked very brutal.
Because that was what? That was like three or four stories up. We might need to get the Mythbusters out of retirement to really see. I thought for a second from the way we saw from the front, and again, not to put the cart before the horse too much, considering we're talking about what happened in the last like 5 minutes of the episode. But I mean, at first I thought it like legitimately like squished him like a bug.
Now
it
did.
I think from the overhead we saw that he more so just collapsed. But from the angle we saw initially, it looked very gruesome.
Yeah, it looked extremely gruesome. So you're right, though. We are kind of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. Like I said, this is the Fargo Podcast that is going to be, of course, a weekly show, hopefully, as long as nothing happens to one of me or Mike. You know, if an air conditioning unit falls on one of us, that would be just tragic. Because, you know, I'd hate to see the podcast end that way, Mike. That would just be terrible, right?
Yeah. I guess if I'd rather get crushed by an air conditioner than have my mouth glued shut and have to sit in front of a freezer the entire night beeping. The beeping was probably what drove him to die, not necessarily everything else included.
Right, exactly. So, so this is going to be a weekly show where we're going to be breaking down the wonderful show that is Fargo. Oh, my goodness, I almost said Mad Men. Can you believe that? It's been so long since I even talked about Mad Men. But, yes, Fargo. And this particular episode, Mike, is titled The Law of Vacant Places. And the episode was directed and written by the man, the myth, the legend, Noah Hawley. So basically, he had full control over this one, which we had heard early on that he was going to be doing that. I don't have any check to see if he's going to be doing this with some of the other ones. Maybe the finale, perhaps? I can't remember.
So. And I think, you know, Hawley is enough of a chief overseer, even though he's got a million irons in the fire. I think he does oversee the show Fargo enough that even if he's not directing or writing episodes, I think he definitely has, you know, the ultimate creative thumbs up or thumbs down on things. So even though he might not have his hands directly in some future episodes, suffice to say his footprint is going to be all over this crime scene.
Yeah, exactly. Which is great because I like him in the driver's seat myself. I think he does a fine job. And when I know he is going to be involved heavily, I know it's probably going to be a great episode. So let's go ahead and just dive right into this, unless there's anything else you wanted to say here at the top of the show, Mike.
No, I mean, do we want to talk a little bit about the title itself? I mean, I feel like season two especially got very heady with these titles. I believe The Law of Vacant Places is a reference to Bridge, which again seems to be Nikki and Ray's game of choice to the point of where they're pursuing some sort of low-key career in it. But obviously this sort of has a nice, in true Fargo fashion, double entendre in that, you know, the whole domino that sets off this chain of events that's going to happen over the course of the next season is Maurice heading into a vacant place, or at least what he thinks is a vacant place, and this is where the whole thing starts. So, again, gotta love Noah Hawley with these meaningful titles that mean multiple things.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, I did want to run through that a little bit. I don't know how much thoughts you had on it, but apparently, yes. And it's not just going to be this title. I mean, we won't spoil it for those people who don't want to know what the title of the next episode is. But sort of a spoiler alert, apparently, at least the ones that we know of are all, I think, titled off of this basic, like you said, a logic problem solving for the game of Bridge. Now, this particular title, The Law of Vacant Places. I looked it up. In the card game Bridge, the law or principle of vacant places is a simple method of estimating the probability lo- location of any particular card in the four hands. You can it can be used both to aid in a decision at the table and to derive the entire suit division probability of the table. So now I'm saying these things. Now, Mike, I don't know about you. I really am not familiar with the game Bridge. What about yourself? Are you familiar with this game at all?
No, I'm under the age of 60, so chances are I probably don't know what the game is. No offense to you Bridge players out there, but it is interesting the way you read that definition off, because it almost seems like a form of card counting in Bridge, right? That's what it sounds like to me, at least on the surface, is that you know the cards that have been played, therefore you make a reasonable assumption about where a certain card might be either in the deck or in some of your players' hands. Again, I don't know how Bridge works. I'm not entirely sure what that means, but again, it goes back to this other meaning of, you know, not only going literally into vacant places, but in that regard, guessing where your opponent might be, or, you know, where your the most valuable cards might be in your opponent's hands. I think that that's going to come into play much, much more as these coalitions and individuals begin to really intersect as this double murder that is sort of related but not completely related is going to unfurl.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, that is a job, of course, is going to be the job of Karen Kuhn's character to try to figure out what exactly happened here. So but the titles, you know, so I don't, obviously Bridge is definitely going to, the game of Bridge is definitely going to be a big part, I think, of the maybe the overlying themes, you think, or something like that. But it's going to have a big part of this season for sure, because like you said, two of our main characters are apparently big time players. They really like it. The only thing I could think of is when it's like, wow, maybe Bridge is like the poker of the Midwest. What do you think? Is that possible? Because I had no idea that they had tournaments and potential sponsors and all this stuff for the game of Bridge. I really didn't know this.
It reminded me of like that King of the Hill episode where they had the big Boggle tournament that Peggy was participating in. Maybe there's just small corners of the world in which this is really a big thing, because yeah, I mean, I obviously know next to nothing about Bridge, but I know absolutely nothing about the world of competitive Bridge. I don't know if there's a World Series of Bridge. That feels like that would be something on ESPN 8, the Ocho, that would be broadcast at like 4 in the morning. But it seems like, you know, there are regionals and there might be sectionals and state finals, etc. So you feel like there needs to be at least some sort of infrastructure, at least within the Midwest, to support that Bridge culture, considering that Ray and Nikki are kind of trying to use this as their cash cow for a bit, saying, you know, eventually you don't need to be a PO because we're going to be able to hitch our ride on this sort of rising star that is our Bridge career.
Yeah, she was very convincing that they're riding to the top on this thing. This is going to be big for them. And, you know, they go to this big tournament, you know, not to jump ahead too much, and they finish third. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's good or not. But, you know, yeah, they really are putting their card, shall we say, really, that they're going to do very, very well with this. So I definitely think that it's not the last time we're going to see them playing Bridge. I would think there's a good chance we might see it again. But yeah, I do like this. Yeah, Noah Hawley loves to throw a lot of this stuff at us and makes us think about what some of these meanings could mean with the overall theme and the narrative of what's going to happen this season. So it's going to be fascinating to definitely pay attention. One of the things I want to ask you before we jump into, like, you know, some of these other big moments, what did you feel about this episode overall? I mean, was it pretty solid? Is there anything that you took away from it that you really, really, really enjoyed or maybe disliked?
I mean, it was pretty solid overall. I can't say I was blown away, but I think it was a very solid outing, especially having not watched Fargo in, you know, almost a year and a half at this point. It's really fun to see it back. I'll admit that Fargo is now starting to kind of show its DNA for a premiere episode, considering that this will be the third premiere now where, you know, you'll have a character die 45 minutes in, and maybe another character will die too, one that you thought would be part of the ensemble initially, but really is not. And so, as we talked about in our preview, there are some stock characters as well. I will say that, you know, I wouldn't say malign the show, but I think I talked in the preview show about the fact that Fargo tends to paint their characters in very broad lines sometimes. Here, I feel like they're actually depicting these characters in much more gray areas. I think, you know, what we might initially think is like, oh, this is a bad guy, this is a good guy. We show that they sort of get involved in different activities that sort of paint them on the other side of the spectrum as well. So I'm happy about that. I will also say, especially compared to season 2, this premiere feels much more self-contained. again, no idea. We have 9 more episodes to go if this is going to balloon out into extreme proportions like season 2 did. But as someone who really loved how small season 1 was and how it was really just a set core of characters focusing in on each other, I'm happy about that. You know, we do have an outsider coming in the form of the Narwhal Corporation, but, you know, we don't have any other mafia organizations or, you know, a variety of cities and their crime organizations to deal with as of yet. So I'm so happy to see Fargo back on my screen. I was sufficiently satisfied with this episode. How about you, Jeremiah?
Yeah, I thought it was a very solid episode as well. And it's funny because one of the big takeaways I had from this was the fact that it did feel more like the first season. I know me and you, I think, talked a little bit about it on our preview show. It's like, well, will this one feel a little bit more? Because I think taking that, doing the time hop that we did in the second season by doing the prequel, going back in the 70s, which, by the way, I loved. But it almost made the show feel almost completely different, even though the setting is still the same. It's in the northern Midwest, and it still had that look and stuff. And there was definitely some things there tonally that still was the same. But it is, for some reason, it just kind of distracted. It didn't feel more like what I'm used to when it comes to the movie and then the first season. This one, and I don't know if it's because we're back in a little bit more modern times, it felt a little bit more like what I'm used to seeing, but I did walk away having that feeling like, okay, Fargo feels more like Fargo this time around. And I do agree with you. Right now, it seems that the plot itself is more contained. So there won't be maybe too many things going on to where someone like myself, who is getting older and gets confused a little bit, doesn't have to stop and go, what's going on here? Who is this again? Yeah. Which I know some of our listeners are probably the same way I am. They're getting older and it's hard for me to keep up with this stuff. And I think that this is definitely a more contained story, which I'm very excited about. And there is a few characters that really stood out for me that I'm excited to watch. One of them, of course, being our main antagonist, we assume is going to be one of our main antagonists, which is the his character's name, but that's played by David, the David Tulis, Vegas
VM
Vega.
Oh, Vega.
Varga, that's
Varga,
right.
Yeah.
Whatever. He stood out for me. I can't wait to see more of him on my screen. And I do love what they did with both Emmett and Ray. I think the two of them, like, to me, match up. Like, I felt like both of these characters, although they're very different, the brothers are obviously very different from each other, but together, I feel like I'm getting a good reputation, a good feeling of, like, it feels more like what I expect from a character, one of the main characters from Fargo. So, like, they feel like that both of them match up like a Jerry and a Lester all wrapped up in one. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Like, they kind of feel that way to me, and I'm excited about it because they both offer a lot of entertainment, whether it's comedic entertainment. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch them.
That being
I think it's very solid.
That being said, there are still some Noah Hawley brand weird things going on, and I feel like the very first scene in this episode is a good indicator that, you know, we might be getting back to basics a bit with, you know, as you said, putting it back in this more self-contained atmosphere. We're jumping forward to 2010, only 4 years after the first season, but they're saving some time jumping for this season as well, so not to worry for you time traveler fans out there.
Exactly, yeah. The episode does open up in East Berlin in 1988, where a man apparently, Mike, is being interrogated for a murder that he clearly probably did not do. I know his name is Jacob. How do you pronounce his real last name? Is it Ungerlander? I'm sure I'm going to bounce this up very much, but, you know, he had lived, I guess, in an apartment that this particular person that they feel like has murdered this woman had lived there. So this is a clear showing of mistaken identity, which is definitely going to be a major part of the theme of this episode, and not only in the season, probably most likely, because we have a lot of mistaken identity happening on later on in the episode. So yeah, we open up and it's that whole scene was really tough to watch because I'm feeling for this guy. I barely know anything about him. I just know that he's, you know, under this communist country that, you know, he knows he's in a lot of trouble. The guy gets so upset that eventually we see him peeing. So I thought, wow, I really felt bad for this guy. What did you think about this opening scene that we had?
Yes, Mr. Undertaker, I guess we'll go with that. This was very interesting because, you know, I cover the Leftovers on the Jay and Jack Network as well, and this almost felt reminiscent of something they would do in a season premiere of the Leftovers, at least the past couple seasons, where they'll sort of take this scene that's completely out of the regular timeline of the action that we're used to, but also use it mm-hmm. to sort of represent thematically what's going to be happening on this season. And I feel like it's no different here. At first, I agree, I was a little confused as to why, you know, we're getting Inglourious Basterds Part 2 here. But I think it does represent some key themes of Fargo, which is always, you know, misunderstandings and also the shortcomings that comes with bureaucracy. You know, there's this really interesting moment where the officer's interrogating him and he says, it presents sort of a paradox to him of saying, well, there's two possibilities here. Either you're lying and you are someone who murdered your wife the other day, or that means the state is lying. And in this society that we live in before the Berlin Wall fell down, you do not say the state is wrong, or you will pay the consequences for that. So I agree. I totally feel for this guy, but I feel like it presents some really great themes, including one that the officer outlines very succinctly when he's saying, you know, Jacob's trying to defend himself, and he says, well, look, this death is a fact. Your explanations are a story. And he says verbatim, we are here to tell the truth. And Noah Hawley, before season 3, really talked about how this season of Fargo in particular is sort of like the capital T truth versus the lowercase t truth of, you know, what exactly is the truth and how can we exactly use storytelling in our own POVs, our own perspectives, to warp said truth. And the text that we see every single episode on Fargo is, this is a true story, and then you see true fade away slowly, and then it says, this is a story, for about 2 seconds. And we've seen parts of this show that have been very out of the ordinary. The first season, you have, and I'm going to warn you all at the top here, I know we like saved a little bit of a spoiler section in our preview to talk about stuff from the previous two seasons. I think I speak on behalf of Jeremiah and myself when I say it's fair game. We're probably going to be talking about actions and events from the first two seasons here. So I apologize if we inadvertently spoil things. But again, this show, even though it functions in an anthology perspective, it's still linked. So I feel like it's fair game from that perspective. But season one, for example, you have Oliver Platt's character have a big old fish fall on his car from the sky. Season two, you have obviously the aliens, which are very polarizing. So I think Fargo is not afraid to necessarily say, hey, this is the quote-unquote truth that you're getting, but at the same time, it is a story, and things might be exaggerated, and things might be incorrect. So I really enjoy that as a sort of getting back into the environment of Fargo, even though it might seem weird at the time, why are we investigating a scene that takes 22 years, placed 22 years earlier with no real ramifications unless this Yuri Gurkha happens to, you know, play a prominent role in this season. But I think it does a great job in a microcosm of representing the key themes and tenets that come with the Fargo franchise.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you mention that because maybe it's because, you know, The Leftovers was fresh on my mind, but that is exactly how I felt about this opening little short cold open here, because I did feel like that, you know, because it was certainly is setting us up thematically for this particular season. But it was beautifully done, you know, like maybe not quite as beautiful as the opening we had of this premiere of the last season of The Leftovers, but still very well done. And you get caught up in the moment, and even though in the end, none of it happens, what happens to that poor guy really doesn't matter in the end, because the story isn't about him. But it is great how they were able to, like you said, set the tone for what thematically we're going to be looking at in this particular season. Because for me, Mike, I'm kind of excited about this idea, because I love stories. I love crime stories where it does involve mistaken identity and things like that, because they're so compelling. Because I put myself in those situations, because I start thinking, what if that's me? What if I get caught in a mistaken identity situation? Like, how miserable would that be, and how terrible would it be? Provided, of course, I lived through it. But yeah, so I'm really excited about this, and I really did like the way they did that. And hopefully, maybe, you know, if there is more seasons of Fargo, we could maybe look to see if having this happen more often. Maybe every season they'll open up with something like that. But it was really great. But we jump ahead right afterwards, of course, to modern time in Minnesota in 2010, where Emmett and Sia are having a meeting with a guy. I think I wrote this down right. I believe his name was Buck, right? Mm-hmm. Did I write that down correctly?
Yeah.
So apparently Buck is the one that had given them the name of this this company that apparently they had borrowed some money, took out a loan for to help them, because apparently they got in some rough times the year before, which, as you wisely mentioned during our preview show, is that this time period is after the financial crash that we had after 2008-2009 time period. So things obviously were rough for them. They needed some money. They borrowed some money, and apparently they want to pay it back, and they're trying to get a hold of these people at this company, and no one is answering the phone. Apparently it's just nothing but clicks and buzzards. So what did you think about it almost felt like they were kind of interrogating this poor guy. He felt very uncomfortable during this conversation, I thought, at one point towards the end. Didn't you think that way?
Yeah, this whole scene, first scene that takes place in Emmett's place, was very reminiscent of The Godfather to me, to the point of where, you know, Emmett's donning this white tuxedo. It's almost like he was saying, right, like, oh, you come to me on this, the day of my 25th anniversary, to talk about these bonds, yeah? Again, still trying to work on that that Minnesotan accent as we progress through here.
Yeah.
I think it's a really it's really fun, though, because I was intrigued about this whole Emmett-Sy dynamic, because obviously we didn't know too much about it coming in. I know that Sy and Nikki were sort of marketed as the respective number twos of the brothers, but it's so interesting to chart how different the relationships are. I mean, Emmett and Sy practically finish each other's sentences, both in this scene and when they're talking to Varga later. They almost pick right up where the other one is left off. They truly represent a partnership there, whereas we'll definitely talk about how Nikki may or may not be manipulating Ray in a variety of ways. It definitely does seems like more of a one-sided partnership there, but yeah, really interesting introduction to Emmett. I mean, quite literally, again, from the garb he's wearing, he seems to be, to come across at least, as the BMOC in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two of them, like you said, they definitely finish each other's sentences. They basically won. We get that even more here in the next scene a little bit later on with their meeting with their brother, his brother Ray. But yeah, and I felt like they're definitely some, since he's obviously very powerful in town, right? He's the parking lot king of the area. So we know the guy's got money, he's got power. I feel like that whole exchange felt like that, you know, Buck was feeling uncomfortable because, you know, these are guys you don't want to really piss off or get upset, you know, and it just felt like they almost kind of were bullying him a little bit, like in a nice way. Like they're trying to do it as nice a way as possible, is with that, you know, heavy northern Midwest accent that we talk so much about, where they're just like, oh, yeah, you know, you sure, you know, just clicks and buzzes. I don't understand. Are you sure you got the right number? You know, they were trying to do it in a nice way, but you could tell he was uncomfortable. And I thought it was very interesting insight into how these guys operate. And it was fascinating. I thought we learned a lot just from that short exchange between the three of them.
What did you think about Emmett's story with his wife, Stella, about, you know, how they met? Because as much as we talked about how there really were no ramifications from the first scene into the main storyline, I feel like Emmett and Stella's storyline about, you know, happening to have the same address as a previous tenant is very familiar to our poor Mr. Undertaker in that first
scene. Jacob. Yeah, I thought that too. I'm sure all of this, of course, is done on purpose, and it was nicely done. The number 16, I did not even think to write down what did they give in the 1988 storyline. Did they even give the exact apartment number? I can't remember now. I did not think to write that down. But yeah, so that whole part of there was very interesting. I don't know what to think about their relationship. It was fascinating. I mean, to me, it almost kind of felt like the biggest thing they were setting up was the fact that, you know, he's got this brother. Like, it seemed like so much concentration on Ray's reactions to the story. You know, he was kind of like, oh God, you know, like he was so annoyed, like, let's get this over with. You know, you could tell right away that, you know, Ray is not a fan of Emmett whatsoever, and probably could care less that his brother, his successful brother, is celebrating his 25th anniversary with his wife Stella, who kind of reminded me a little bit of Stifler's mom if she had blonde hair.
Jennifer Coolidge, that would have been a huge get for this season of Fargo.
Was I the only one who kind of felt that way a little bit when I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. But apparently he bought her a lobster the size of a car. Did I write that down right?
Yeah, that's like a lost
big muscle, huge lobster.
It's like a B-52's lyric. That's, and for making, you know, meager pennies at Red Robin, apparently. And as we talked about, this could just be a story. He could fudge the facts, especially considering he's pretty affluent now. But like you said before, it seems like Ray and Nikki really stick out like sore thumbs here. Everyone else seems pretty preppy and buttoned up, and there they are just kind of like sulking in the back. You know, Nikki's grabbing as many hors d'oeuvres as she can, and Ray just throws his champagne into the nearest potted plant before he goes up for that meeting.
That's a very good point. You're right. They did stand out so badly. Like, they got, like, these two accidentally got invited to the wrong party. So, like, look around. Hey, are we supposed to be here? I don't think so. I mean, you wonder. I mean, you assume everyone at this party probably knows who Ray is and are not shocked. But if somebody happened to show up to that meeting and was just maybe new to Emmett's life and is not aware of his brother being being the way Ray is, might have looked over and go, who the hell is this guy? Who's this girl he's with? I mean, where'd they find this chick at?
So what did you think about, you know, we talked about our introduction to Emmett. Here we get this introduction to Ray, and it really comes full force in this sit down with Emmett. So initial impressions on Ray and at least how he compares to Emmett. Starting off, did you think there was an inherent quote-unquote good brother and bad brother?
It's definitely the vibe they're going for a little bit, although it's kind of hard to say because you're immediately given the impression, of course, that Ray is the bad brother, but in the end, maybe it's Emmett. I mean, I don't really think either one of these two guys necessarily are good or bad. I don't think either one of them are great, to be honest with you. But yeah, they kind of set that up. I mean, I was trying to figure out in the end, okay, so obviously we go back upstairs to this, I guess is that his office? I guess it is his office or something,
I'm assuming
huge.
It's at his home, so it's his home office.
Right.
I have no idea what business he conducts there, but you know, he has probably the biggest mansion in the city that, you know, it's where he conducts all of his business. Like I said, he's the godfather. He's pulling people into side rooms to broker deals even during this conversation. I mean, Jeremiah, he was apparently brokering deals during his daughter's wedding. That's how good of a businessman he is.
Exactly. I loved how just going up to have this meeting take place, how Cy was able to say, hey, I squeezed you in for 5 minutes. So like right off the bat, you could tell, obviously the two of them knew what this meeting was going to be about. They didn't want to have the meeting, but they're like, fine, we'll have it. We'll just get this over with right away. They're annoyed immediately right off the bat. But yeah, we learned so much about these two and the relationship just in this interaction that it's just I don't know how much more. I mean, really, I feel like we really know these guys pretty well. So let's talk about the big crust of the conversation, obviously, is that, yes, Ray wants some money, right? He wants to buy Nikki, his new girlfriend, a ring. I guess he wants to propose, which, by the way, Ray, that's a bad idea. But we'll talk about that later.
I don't know if you heard Emmett say, like, again. So I have to wonder if Ray had been married, engaged before. Maybe this exact same scenario happened where he fell in love with one of his parolees and she ended up taking off on him. Again, I'm gonna have a lot to say about Nikki. I have a feeling from the reaction that, you know, that she knew that he was buying the ring, I'm pretty sure she asked him to ask Emmett for money for the ring.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things we're going to probably talk a lot about with those two's relationship, because, you know, it's clear who's wearing the pants in that one. But, you know, so this interaction, I think the most important thing we're supposed to be taken away from this is what this rivalry is all about, which is apparently, from what I can understand, is in a nutshell, at some point when they were kids, Ray traded these stamps for his brother's for the brother's Corvette. He wanted the Corvette, I guess, instead of stamps. So Emmett gets the stamps in this trade. Ray gets this Corvette, right? And apparently, of course, these stamps were vintage and worth a fortune. And Ray feels like he, you know, got gypped by his brother, and he feels like he owes him for it. Am I missing anything? What else am I missing from this? Is that essentially it in a nutshell?
So I think the thing that you're missing, I don't know if you recall when he said, you know, a dad, you know, collapsed in the driveway. I'm pretty sure when their dad died, he bequeathed to his sons in his will the car to Emmett and the stamps to Rey. I think that's
okay.
Why
yeah,
go ahead.
That's right. I do remember him saying that, and I forgot. So yeah, okay, yes, that makes a lot of sense then.
Because it contrasts nicely to, you know, Rey is insisting to Emmett that, you know, this is a will, this is a legal binding document, and Emmett sort of throws his hands and he's like, ah, that doesn't matter. And then we'll contrast that to later on when they're, you know, encumbered by Varga, and Varga says like, oh yeah, like, you know, they say to him, oh, you know, we signed a contract, you know, this is a loan, this is not an investment, and Varga's like, oh, I don't care. He throws his hands up almost. So, again, really fun power positions and swapping even within this first episode of Fargo, and this is one example of that.
Right. So, essentially, I mean, you can call it a trade, but at some point, yes, the two brothers makes this deal that he would take the Corvette and they would take the stamps. So I can understand it. I can definitely understand Ray's point. Is like, if these stamps are worth way more than the Corvette, you know, obviously Ray did get screwed there. And I'm assuming that the father didn't want the two brothers to be fighting over the money. I mean, I'm sure at some point, whatever had value, he'd want the brothers to get equal amount of it. And I'm sure that's the way Ray looked at it. But obviously Emmett does not. You know, he's like, haha, you know, finders keepers, or, you know, like, hey, you said I can have the stamps, so tough crap. And I find it's very interesting that he obviously saved just the one and he has it framed. I wonder, do you think that is that one worth the most? I wonder what is the significance of that particular stamp? I don't feel like we got that in this exchange necessarily, did we?
Did you see the image that was on the stamp?
Well, I didn't get a chance to really look at it close enough. So what am I missing? What is on the stamp?
I believe it's a figure pushing a boulder up a hill a la Sisyphus. And again, that just might be
really
under the surface representation. I don't think Emmett was really going for that. My best guess is that he, you know, Ray said, you know, they had 2 dozen, 3 dozen stamps. I'm pretty sure Emmett probably made, you know, his first good amount of money that he invested and summarily really became rich off of by selling all of those stamps, probably except one. I want to, you know, read between the lines and say that stamp might be the most valuable, which is why he sort of keeps it around and is able to sort of taunt Ray with it. But I mean, Ray's going to say later that what he wanted with the stamp was more so symbolic than it really was anything of significant value. Though, again, I'm not a representation of the Antiques Roadshow. I have no idea what one vintage stamp will be able to net you, especially if it was enough to buy a significant diamond ring. But I mean, Ray really has his blinders on at this point, because getting the stamp not only would be able to net him some money, but it's sort of a way for him to, what he believes, stick it to his brother who screwed him over so many years ago.
Right. Okay. Very good. Well, I mean, I'm sure maybe we'll learn a little bit more about that particular stamp, because, you know, I'm they had a nice shot. I mean, they made a big point to show the stamp and where it was at, which it had a lot of significance to the remainder of the story. But I just thought it was kind of fascinating. But I'm sure there'll be more discussion about the one vintage stamp that's left that has not been sold yet. That leads into some very, very bad things here as the episode goes on. Now, so we see after Ray leaves, you know, obviously he's disappointed. This meeting did not go the way Ray wanted it whatsoever, because obviously they were sort of kind of telling the truth a little bit. I mean, they obviously did have some money issues, but I don't feel like at this point, I feel like if Emmett wanted to give him some money, he could. But I just love how he just like to remind him about all the times he gave him money, and yet, you know, like, and I love how he's like, and I don't mind helping, I don't mind at all, you know, which is a bunch of BS. I mean, obviously, yes, he definitely minds giving him money, but the whole thing was so fascinating. But yeah, so we get to learn a lot about Ray right off the bat too. When he goes to leave, you know, his attitude obviously is not great. Tells Nikki basically that, you know, hey, they don't have the money right now, it's bad timing. But when he drives away, the Corvette pulls up, and you realize, wow, this thing's a piece.
Yeah, I mean, like, no offense to Ray here, but I mean, you might be given arguably the short end of the will stick with that Corvette, but at least like refurbish it, man. I know you don't have too much money to your name, but do something to it if it's like the only commodity you have to your name.
Yeah, you would think so. You would think so, but that thing looks like it's had way, way better days. It looked like it was barely running. It was wow. And then of course the license plates. that was priceless. The ace hole. I of course immediately thought of our main villain from the first season, where because he always kept saying aces, which of course Lauren Mulvo was. Remember, he used to always say aces.
So I saw ace hole. And I mean, went to Survivor Gabon when I don't know if you remember when Sugar voted off Ace. I believe she wrote ace hole on her vote. So that's where my mind was at personally.
Wow. No, I do not remember her writing ace hole. But okay, that's great. Yeah. So yeah, and of course the fact that Ray doesn't want to tip the guy and tells him to get a real job, that was pretty cold. So I took away like, wow, Ray is kind of a douchebag here.
But we have someone to soften him here in the form of Nikki. And again, this is when I started to really think like, Nikki definitely has some subterfuge to her. I mean, she's going to tell him like, you know, we're simpatico. You know, you're the hand and I'm the glove. I'm pretty sure it's the other way around, where Nikki is definitely guiding the action, whereas Ray is sort of going to be the one to protect her if and when things come for that hand. The glove's going to get scratched first before the hand.
Right. That's the biggest thing I got from this conversation with the two of them in the car. I mean, that it totally set the tone of this relationship. I mean, she is definitely wearing the pants. He will do or say anything for her. It's clearly one-sided, that's for sure. I mean, I have to admit, at times I'm going, why exactly is she with him? I don't know. I mean, she's definitely using him somehow, but for what? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm not clear about this yet.
I mean, Jeremiah, true love exists in many forms. We have no idea if Nikki actually has sexual attraction to Ray. No offense to Ewan McGregor, but Ray might want to invest in a gym membership as well if he gets some money from Emmett.
Yeah.
Maybe the Hair Club for Men membership as well. But yeah, you have to wonder at least initially that, you know, she is clearly using him, whether this means to advance her bridge career or whether this means to skirt the other felony she's been affiliated with. I'm not entirely sure, but she is, from the final scene shows, she's a smooth operator, considering that, you know, she's the one to realize, let me go to the air conditioner, let me time out how long it's going to take him to walk underneath.
And
she tells Ray immediately, I bought our apartment under a fake name. Oh, this is what you immediately need to do. This is the alibi I'm going to give the cops. It's clear that this is not her first time at the rodeo. And Ray, on the other hand, is probably going to get bucked off immediately.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, Nikki has been in and out of trouble. She definitely has a rough past, but she is extreme, like I said, very bright, intelligent person. So, like, the two of them being together does kind of make me wonder, unless she just really likes to have someone she can control, which makes a lot of sense as well. Or, like you said, maybe he is just really that good at bridge. You know, and she needs that bridge, that expert bridge player. I have no idea. Because, obviously, they already start talking about this Wildcat regionals that she wants to go to and wants Ray to help her break her paroles just so she can go to this thing. So it was a fascinating interaction between the two of them, but I thought it really set up this relationship big time.
And I miss the music choices in Fargo. I'm so happy they're back, in particular because as a big classic rock fan, to hear, you know, the driving guitar power chords of Heart playing Crazy on You, just a great way to start the season. And this was an entirely uncut segment as well. We take our first commercial break here 20 minutes in, which I think is great.
Yeah.
You know, FX has been great to Fargo in that they really can do episodes however long they want. Last season, I feel like episodes ranged from like 60 to 75 to 90 minutes sometimes with commercials. They really have free reign of the territory there. I'm happy that, you know, they're experimenting with a 20-minute cold open, for instance. I mean, if this was a half-hour show, that's almost when the show would be over. It's almost like doing one long, uninterrupted sitcom episode by comparison.
Yeah, 20 minutes is definitely the longest cold open we may have ever seen on any TV show. Matt, I can't even – I mean, I did not time out any of the cold opens from last season, but you're right. They were long as well, and they do have a lot of liberty, which is great that they were able to do that. And you're really deep into it by the time we have a commercial. And then when we come back from the commercial is when we are first introduced to Gloria, which is our beloved Carrie Coon, who we love so much. And we finally get to meet her, and she goes to a little general store, it looks like, that apparently is owned by – at first I thought it was her father because she kept calling him Pops, but apparently it's a stepfather. And the significance I thought was interesting is the fact that the sensor, for whatever reason, didn't work for her and the door didn't open. I have no idea necessarily yet for sure what that has to do. Did you have any thoughts on that necessarily? Did you read any great theories or anything like that?
So if I'm to assume that Gloria Burgle, which again is an amazing name, is going to be Molly Salverson / Marge Gunderson analog of this show, it means that she is going to be a cop who is consistently doing things behind the scenes. She's going to go to other police officers. They're going to say, oh, no, no, it's not that. No, you're chasing down a cold lead there. Don't go down there. There's other crimes perspiring. But it seems like she's going to doggedly pursue it. Maybe that's what the censor is sort of representing here, the fact that, you know, she's not detected at all, both by the door and maybe by her superiors. It is interesting to me, this might be one of the first episodes, I should say, where our main cop was actually not shown at work. Even though she does sort of infiltrate the house later on when she finds out that somebody broke in, she's not in uniform. We pretty much see Gloria the civilian before we see Gloria the cop, which I think is a nice, interesting turn in that it's clear that Gloria, I think, has much more of a broken home life or a more eventful past than those other two characters, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
She definitely is very different. You think about the movie introduction there, and then of course in the first season with Molly. I mean, I think if I remember right, I mean most of them were all introduced at first as them, you know, as an officer of the law before anything else. So you're right. They clearly are trying to do something very different with Gloria, which is great. I like that. She definitely is bringing something a little bit different to the table. But in the end, she's definitely going to be the one investigating what is going on. So she's going to be a big part of it. I don't know how much, you know, how interesting this character will be. I mean, right now I didn't get a whole lot necessarily from her in this episode. But I think with everything else that's going on, you know, her portion of what's going to happen in the overall narrative is obviously going to pick up here as the, you know, season goes on. But it was, just fascinating that was something. Of course, they made a big deal about it, the door not opening. So we'll see how that plays out. But we had these like transition shots of Ray's daily life with a lot of people going to get their pee test done. I don't know what to say, but other than the fact that, the first thing that stood out to me is, wow, more pee. I mean, we just got done seeing poor Jacob pee his pants when he realized he's probably going to either jail the rest of his life or maybe even worse, the death sentence. And we get to see poor Ray having to endure a constant pee test as a parole officer. I don't think his life is – it doesn't seem that great, does it?
No, I mean, this definitely puts the number one in episode number one of Fargo season 3. Never thought in my life, Jeremiah, that I'd see a show where there were transition shots of peeing.
Yeah.
But I guess it's a way to sort of show the rigmarole that comes with Ray's position. And again, a great music choice in the background, moaning, to sort of, you know, the lyrics loosely say, basically, like, every day I'm going through the same BS. And essentially that's what we see with Ray here. It's clear that he's sort of, I don't know if I call this a dead-end job as much as it's just he's sort of stuck in a rut right now, which is totally understandable why he would fall for someone like Nikki, because that's sort of the spark of excitement that he needs. But it seems at least with his meeting from Emmett, he's got a kick in the butt to use his job, the perks of his job, to be able to get what he wants.
Yeah, exactly. And do you think the writers are kind of making us feel a little more sorry for this guy? I mean, I kind of felt that way because, like, I'm watching this going, wow, man, this is what he has to do every day. This is terrible, you know? And maybe it's just because of all the close-up shots of pee going into a cup. I don't know what it was, but I was really feeling sorry for him as this scene was going through. I was like, wow. Ah, poor Ray. But I don't know. What do you think? Are they trying to make us feel a little bit sorry for him? I feel like a little bit, right?
I almost feel like by the time he got in the car and was talking with Nikki, we start to see Ray as less of a curmudgeon and more like a feckless guy. Someone who just like is a little meek. So I think this was just sort of adding on to the pile that we'll be slowly amassing. But he's going to try to make a name for himself in this next scene with Maurice, because from what I understand, this whole plan was not Nikki's idea, right? She only found out in the bathroom later on. This was all Ray's plan.
Right. When you see the reaction, which we'll talk about it when we get to it, but the reaction that she had, of course, when Maurice shows up at her apartment while they're in the bathroom, yeah, she was completely surprised. So this is clearly all Ray here wanting to meet up with this Maurice guy in a bar who apparently was someone who's been on parole, failed his P test, and Ray bribes this guy basically, or, you know, enforces him to go and wants him to go and steal the stamp. Immediately I'm just like going, wow, this is such a bad idea in so many ways. I was blown away by this. But the best part about it too was getting to see this character, Maurice. Wow. I love the way he just kept saying,
this is your
cool,
halt and catch
man, fire. Cool.
This is your halt and catch fire guy, right?
Yes, he is from Halt and Catch Fire. Snoot McNair, I believe. Scoot McNair. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Yeah, he's in the show. That's what I'm familiar with him is in Halt and Catch Fire on AMC. His character is obviously a lot different in this particular one because this guy, he apparently spends a lot of time stoned, like a lot of time. You would think he lived in either Denver or Colorado, or Colorado or California,
Seattle.
Right?
Yeah.
Or Seattle. Well, I keep getting lose track here of which states have legalized marijuana, but he is definitely someone who is not with it at any point. And for some reason, and I understand why. I mean, yes, this is someone that Ray felt like he could push around, but wow, this not very well thought out. And then the piece of paper, of course, we have to talk about that he writes the information down on. Well, I know it said things to do today, but why does it have a silhouette of two adults having relations with each other? Where did he get this notepad, a piece of paper?
You got to pass the time at the parole office, right? I'm sure that nobody else really sees the notes that he's taking down. Maybe he thought maybe Nikki got it for him as a sexy present to help him get through the 9-to-5. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe it was a gag gift, or he had to find, you know, what's the least likely stationery that can get me caught. As you said, Ray is, and this will be leading into, you know, future episodes, I'm sure, Ray is gonna leave a lot of pieces of evidence leading right back to himself. Who knows if maybe this piece of paper, this wayward piece of paper, is gonna be found out in the field eventually that might end up, you know, finding them back to at his desk. You know, you shouldn't have gotten the pornography stationery, Ray. This is what you got you in trouble in the first place. But yeah, I guess this is where Ray uses his knowledge, right? Because he knows that Maurice is sort of a petty thief. He's been busted before for stealing flat screen TVs. Really nice callback again to the initial themes we talked about with Maurice saying, like, oh yeah, allegedly. And Ray tells him, when they convict you, it turns into a fact, which again is another great shout out to facts, capital T truth versus lowercase t truth. But yeah, this plan just seems horrible from the get-go. Even if Maurice successfully made his way into Emmett's house, you have to assume that not only will Emmett be home, but his entire family will be home.
Right.
Is he essentially sending Maurice into like a suicide mission? Like, how does it? Maurice can't be that good of a thief to be able to sneak in and sneak out so quickly. He's much more of like a wet bandit from Home Alone, and that he's gonna totally do things up along the way and not get that stamp.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what the guy's thinking, but wow. And we do get a glimpse in the next scene with what's going on with him. And I mean, obviously he wasn't home. Like you said, everybody was at his house. So, you know, this is not a good evening to be going over there, although he does receive a phone call from Cy that apparently a gentleman from this company that they've been trying to get a hold of about the loan they owe has come to visit, and he has to go back to the office. The only thing I thought that was interesting is they did want to show us that Emmett apparently does own a pair of house slippers.
Yeah, I was wondering if this is Chekhov's house slippers for some reason, because again, this is going to be our MO on the Fargo podcast, is getting super granular with these. I wonder if it was just a fun character choice, or if it's something that's going to be of significance later, that, you know, maybe Emmett's life hangs in the balance because he decides for a second to change out of his house slippers, and as a result, you know, whoever's gunning him down has the jump on him for that 1 second. I'm not entirely sure, but if it's just a fun character moment, It's a fun character moment at that. But who knows? It might grow into something larger.
Yeah, that's what's great about this show is that, especially this particular one, because most of the shows me and you enjoy quite a bit, every scene, every shot is usually for some reason. And Fargo is that one kind of show that it probably is for some reason, but it could, like you said, just be a character moment, and they just thought it'd be funny to show you that he had house slippers. Or, like you said, there could be some significance to it as time goes on. But you know, we'll see. But that was very interesting. But the next scene, Mike, to me, was maybe my favorite, because I was laughing so hard during this moment where Maurice apparently is getting therapy over the phone while driving, getting high off of this kite again. This whole collection of him, like, going through this conversation with the therapist. Then, of course, practically burning himself by dropping his lit marijuana cigarette in his lap, and then losing the piece of paper that had all the address and the information on it. The whole collection of comical moments here was just phenomenal. And then, of course, hearing his montage there of, like, his insightful knowledge is about morgues being always in the basement of hospitals, and where does the president get clothes? I mean, all these things were just so beautifully done, and I thought Scoot did a great job just highlighting this whole thing. I thought it was wonderful. What did you think about this moment with Maurice in the car?
It was probably the best comic scene of the episode. And again, Fargo is a show that exists purely in its dark comedy. So that being said, I mean, this is going to be a real tour de force for Maurice this latter half of the episode. I am going to miss him a bit just because he's going to bring this really silly aloofness to it. He almost reminds me of Ry Gerhardt in that regard, in that he seems like someone who is in totally over his head, but at the same time has, like, a hair trigger temper. You know, as we'll see later, it seems like he has a real penchant for violence when he doesn't get his way, which I think totally runs counter to this talk he has with the shrink, which, again, fun sign of the times that he's able to talk with his shrink over the phone while he's driving. Definitely would not have that in Fargo season 2. But yeah, I love that he's like, I define myself by my thoughts. And his thoughts are, like, definitely the things you would come up with when you're high. Like, where does the president get his clothes tailored? It's just, like, all the random musings. If that's really what Maurice is made up of, this guy is truly enigmatic. But, I mean, I talked about Domino's before, this is really the first push. You know, you could argue, had Maurice not burned himself on his blunt in the car, he wouldn't open the window, he'd have gone to the correct address. Who knows what would have happened from there, but it would not have led him to Anastasia's porch, and then I'm assumingly all the events over the course of the season would not have taken place.
Of course. So you did that sliding door, that one moment. If something would have changed right here, everything would have been different. So, but you know, that's what makes a guy like Maurice is so perfect, because he is the guy who's going to screw this up somehow. And it was great. So, but yeah, it was a great scene. I just enjoyed it so much. But I'm gonna miss Maurice on our screen for sure, because it's definitely a great character. But we have other ones to watch, and now we get this next scene, which is obviously setting up so much importance to, I'm sure, what is going to happen between Cy and Emmett's lives here as the season goes on. Is this meeting with VM Vargo, which we talked a little bit about earlier. They said that this right away is going to be someone I'm going to be watching very closely. Essentially, you know, these two guys, you know, they're just one, you know, they want to pay the, all they want to do is pay this company back. And we're basically told that, hey, we basically here in Norwal made an investment, which, by the way, they're in America. We made this $1 million investment in you. It's not a loan. And it's basically tell them that we're kind of taking over.
Yeah.
The looks on their faces was just priceless.
Well,
I love
this. It's a great
this.
Power reversal, because these guys seem like they were the big gangsters. You know, they were sort of the big fish in the small pond of Minnesota. And now they realize that, oh no, they're very quickly moved into the ocean at this point, and the sharks are chomping at the bit here. And VM Vargo, we talked about this in the preview, it's so much fun to see him, as you said, apparently set up as this big bad, because he looks so unassuming at the surface. He totally seems like someone who would wear like a $50 hand-me-down suit. His hair is constantly ruffled, his teeth is an entirely different subject matter on its own. I'm sure a dentist could write an entire dissertation about that. But he really controls the room. He really, and he almost controls the language, too. I mean, he tells them, you know, you're confusing the word singularity with the word continuity. It's not a loan. It's an investment. You know, this is not an ending. This is a beginning. He really takes control in that room for a variety of reasons. And it's so much fun to just see that power of reversal so quick in the episode. Narwhal is an interesting name for the company as well, because as the very addictive internet song might allude to, narwhals are those whales that have the big horns on them. And I think the whale symbology is interesting because, as you mentioned before, they Emmett and Cy mentioned that when they tried to call Narwhal initially to reach Mr. Rick Ehrmantraut, who I don't think that means a crossover with the Better Call Saul universe. I apologize to TV lovers out there. I don't think Prestige TV is that well connected, unfortunately. But, you know, the clicks and beeps might not be unlike the sounds that a whale makes. So I feel like that might have been a nice connection there, even though that is a weird sort of holding music, if true.
Yeah, exactly. And I do agree. It was so beautifully done to be able to see that the tides had churned so quickly in these two. And it messed up their rhythm. You know, like you talked about earlier about how the two of them finish each other's sentences and they're always in control of the conversation. This guy comes in. He's so calm and smooth about the whole thing. And his choice of words was so brilliant and so well thought out, although he made it seem effortlessly like he wasn't even thinking about it. He just explained to him, you know, what's going on, almost like, and I loved my favorite part was like how he said, you know, like the time to ask questions was when you asked for the money in the first place. That is over now. It's over, fellas. This is how it is now. And we're pretty much, you know, we're going to be in charge here. We're going to be in the ins and outs of what's going on here with your operation. So I thought it was great. I think things are not going to go well now for Emmett Cy. This duo here is in some hot water. They're in some trouble because clearly this group that has made this investment with them is not some people that you want to cross. Just like you said with the tie-in to the communist government. I mean, these are not good people.
Especially since, Varga essentially threatens them at the end by saying, you know, BT Dubs, we have access to all your records already. We already broke in. And we're not entirely sure. You'd have to assume that they're doing some sort of nefarious deeds, considering that it seems like they're almost laundering money through the Stussy Corporation by saying, like, we're just going to be essentially sending money through you to make sure that our names are, you know, taken out of the mud. We'll see exactly what comes of that, whether it means, you know, heads will roll or whether it means something from more of a financial perspective. But yeah, not looking good for the Stussy Corporation at this point.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you what you thought, their intentions were with the company, because that's the only thing I picked up from the conversation was that they were looking for somewhere to launder money. What kind of business they're involved in, what most likely with drugs or who knows what they're into, but it's definitely they're looking for someone, a place to launder their money. And poor Emin and Cy, they made a really bad decision here. This is not good for them whatsoever. Absolutely.
Well, I guess in the financial crisis, when you couldn't turn to the banks, you turned to the companies named after marine life. It seems like the totally logical next step, right?
Right, exactly. So I mean it and they made such a great point too, like, didn't you wonder why someone would be able to just give you $1 million without any collateral?
Again, they had their pie in the sky hopes, especially considering how on rock bottom everyone was during the financial crisis.
Maybe we'll have
some sort of like small flashback as to that moment, or maybe we just surge forward. Either way, it's going to be a very interesting relationship. Also, only seeing that Varga's in, I'm very excited by the fact that they just sort of dropped his name in there for 1 second and then pulled him back out. I don't even think, you know, we see Emmett for the rest of the episode, so we really press pause on that entire storyline.
It was a big time pressing pause, but that's fine because I think there's going to be so much coming out of this that we're going to get a lot of this, and it's going to be great. I have a feeling it was going to be good television that we're going to be viewing. So we do go next. We go back to get a little more glimpse here into what's going on with Gloria's life. We're at apparently her stepfather's house, Enos. Her and her son Nathan is there. They're having dinner together. I guess they wind up having that mac and cheese. They didn't even pay attention to what they're eating, but apparently
they finished the mac and cheese. They moved on to some sort of dessert. I couldn't tell what it was. I just know that it contained
something with strawberries.
Yeah,
I thought maybe it was strawberry shortcake, but I mean, something that had to do with strawberry. Yeah, he apparently does not like strawberries. I don't know what this guy likes. He's a bit of a grump.
He likes beer, and he likes chugging vodka out of the freezer at like 3 in the morning.
Yes. So, yeah, Pops is kind of quite of a character. Of course, God rest his soul, he didn't make it too long. But, yeah, it's I guess the most important thing is we kind of get a setup a little bit about what's going on with her and her career. That was, of course, I think a big part of it. And of course, we get to see a little bit more of Enos, who obviously is going to set up the stage here for this, mistaken identity that happens with Maurice when he shows up. But it was I didn't really take a whole lot necessarily. What else did you, anything else you picked up from this particular conversation that you thought was important for us to highlight at all, or should we move on?
Nothing really to highlight. Like you said, I think it was just a nice peppering in, much like, sprinkling sugar on top of a strawberry shortcake of Gloria's character. You know, we're going to see this ex-husband at the end, I'm assuming from the next time on, and we won't really talk too much about the next time on promos, but it seems like he's going to appear in more of a larger role then. He kind of looks a little bit like the guy who played Bear Gerhardt from season 2. I thought for a second that it was him, but that makes no sense from any timeline perspective. But yeah, it was just setting things up for what's about to fall over the next couple scenes.
Yeah, exactly. And we do finally in the next scene get to see Nikki and Ray playing in the big Wildcats regionals. So that was interesting, getting the tight shots on the game. It was almost kind of almost like a little love affair there for a second about how the game is played. I was very fascinated because, at this point, watching the show, I wasn't even quite sure yet what game we were playing until I did some research and found out it was Bridge. And so I'm like watching this, like, and fascinated as someone who does love card games. But I thought it was very interesting that Ray apparently was the dummy. Now, I did look up that as a term, of course, used in Bridge. She didn't just call him dummy for a reason. Where apparently the Clary's partner, that's who he is, after opening a lead, the dummy places his hands face up on the table, and then the Clarer calls the cards during the play for both hands. So she was just basically declaring what he was at that moment in the game. But I just thought it's funny when she said, called him dummy out. That was just great, because that's kind of what we're thinking all the time when we see Ray is, more and more that we see him, we think, wow, this guy's kind of a dummy.
Wow, Bridge is a really
right?
mean game.
I know, right? It's very harsh. I thought as well. So what else can we take away? I mean, I said it earlier, I definitely think we probably may see them play Bridge more. I don't know. Maybe we don't. I don't know. The more I think about this as we go along, maybe we won't see them play Bridge again.
Ray's pretty much on the run right now. I don't know how much he's going to take the time to stop down for Bridge, but who knows? We might get a Bridge flashback. We'll put a pin in this Bridge for now. I promise you, listeners,
okay,
on behalf of Jeremiah and myself, we will go and research some Bridge, since you said that the titles of these episodes seem to refer to them. So we'll be able to come back and bring more insight to Bridge moving forward, because it seems like whether or not it's actually played, it's going to play a large part over the course of this season.
Too bad we live on opposite ends of the country, my friend. Because otherwise I'd say I'd come over to your house and we'd actually play Bridge together.
We're in the year 2017. I'm sure there's a virtual Bridge that exists.
Do you have... It's probably true. Do you have frozen vodka in your refrigerator for me to drink?
No, we are a wine and rum type of family. So no, Jeremiah, you cannot sit in front of my TV for hours on end grumbling to yourself, then wake up in the wee hours of the dawn, chug a bunch of vodka, and then go back to sleep.
I would be okay with frozen rum.
You're not getting near my stash, man.
Yeah, exactly. If I ever do get to go to your house, I guarantee you the first thing you're going to do is hide all of your frozen rum.
Yes, absolutely.
So we get to move into the next scene. We see Maurice, of course, is struggling to try to figure out where he's supposed to go. And at some point, he winds up going to a gas station and berates this poor guy working there to get the phone book. Clearly, I mean, so much sloppiness is going on with this. It's just mind-blowing. You can just see, like, if Maurice didn't wind up getting killed, he was going to get caught no matter what. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, we're also recording this on the night of April the 20th, and I feel like this is just a nice PSA from Fargo of how much marijuana can have an effect on your memory in particular, as, you know, through a bunch of misunderstandings, Maurice somehow believes he makes the wrong turn. He goes to, you know, was it something valley?
Something about prairie instead of not prairie
Eden,
or something,
Eden,
right?
Prairie instead of, he wants to Eden Valley instead of Eden Prairie.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, you know, shame on the Minnesota Town Council for naming areas so close to each other. But, you know, he's trying to go off of sense memory, and he just grabs that random phone book, and he happens to find an East Dussie, and he assumes that's the place. Poor Ennis Dussie. I mean, I'm sure we both experience things where you've been approached, or you say, like, oh, yeah, Panhorst, are you related to so-and-so Panhorst? That's essentially what this guy got, but, you know, in the form of a murder as a result of an unfortunate association.
Yeah, yeah, poor Ennis. I tell you, he was at the wrong place at the wrong time, obviously, and his name was
place, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so we get this interaction, like I said, he shows up at his house. Things, of course, obviously don't go very well, but wow, what are you going to do, right? I mean, these things happen in the world of Fargo where, you know, if you have the same last name, you know, you could wind up getting killed.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, again, you know, talking about the initial killings that come with Fargo, I mean, we got a question from Chris Areo on Twitter asking, how would you compare the murders from each season premiere? How would you rate them in terms of justification the killers had? And it's interesting in that each of these premieres, one of the core pieces of DNA between all of them is that there is some sort of weird and misunderstanding or coincidence that happens. I mean, it's first season premiere, you have Lester talking to Lorne Malvo in the emergency room, and Lester just sort of offhandedly complaining like, hey, it would be fun if this guy Sam Hess got what was coming to him. And Lorne Malvo warps that and decides to go after him. Season 2, after Ry Gerhardt shoots up this Waffle Hut, he ends up walking out, you know, is sort of taken in by this UFO and gets hit by Peggy in a car. Season 3, now you have wrong address, and as a result, this old man dies. Could you do a quick power ranking of most justified to least justified, quote-unquote, accidental murder in the Fargo premieres?
Boy, this is good. Oh, man. Least justified. Wow. I would go maybe this one.
Mm-hmm. Boy. The least, the most, or the least?
I was leaning towards the least.
Okay.
I mean, if you, boy, should we talk through this? I mean, because, I mean, Rye, don't you feel like, I don't know, I feel like kind of Ryan, he put himself in that position, and that seems pretty justified. What the hell? Get hit by a car? I mean, after doing something
Ryan
bad.
Yeah, I mean, with Ryan, it would seem like a karmic justice, right? Well, actually, all right, this is what I would think. So I think Ryan might be number one, because Ryan got the karmic justice in that, you know, he just committed these heinous activities. Sam Hess arguably did as well in that, you know, he was bullying.
Yeah,
Lester.
He's a bully.
Yeah, and to prove a point,
right, he
to
deserved
his kids,
what he got.
This poor man, even though he might have some very hardline conservative values, especially when it comes to gay marriage, he really has been innocuous in from what we've seen so far. So he seemed to be probably the most innocent out of our three victims in that regard.
I think so. Right. So I think you have to put him there. I think you're. I like the idea of Rye being one. And let's go with Sam 2, and then Enos being the third.
That works for me.
Yeah, I like this. I, you know, it's one of those things, you got to really talk through it, and I feel like that's where I would fall on. So let's definitely go with that. Hopefully that answers the question okay there. But it's one of those things, and I think every season will probably always have something like this to start off with, is that, you know, things seem so innocent sometimes, and then it just takes off into a bad turn. And then this obviously doesn't go very well for this poor guy. And, you know, that's how life is. So, but Gloria and Nathan, they return. So let's talk about this. So they return, right? They get back to the house. She, of course, goes in the house. She finds out that he has passed. I guess at this point, Maurice did get out of the house. At first, we were kind of thinking that maybe he was there, but he's not, because she goes through the house.
She finds him at first. She hears creaking upstairs. She sees Nathan, runs to put Nathan in the police car. Maybe Maurice is more slipped than I initially blamed him. You know, maybe he was able to sneak out in those few minutes, or maybe it was just the wind. I'm not entirely sure.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I struggle with this, because I don't find that, especially the state that Maurice is in, I just can't imagine him being able to do that in the state he was in. I just can't imagine him managing to getting out of the house so quickly, you know, in between that time that she goes out there and comes back. I don't know. I have a hard time with this, that this doesn't seem like. So I assume he was already out of the house. But maybe, yeah, maybe we'll find out more as the investigation goes on or something. But I just feel feeling he was out there. And then, of course, after she goes and sweeps through the house, one of the big things, of course, we see is that she finds there is a hidden compartment through the floorboards. And in there is this box that has a couple of books that you did some research and found out apparently are fictional books. The statue, of course, that we didn't really talk about, but he had apparently carved for his grandson,
which was amazing,
is on the cover.
Amazing artistry from his perspective. I know.
Yeah.
I would not be able to do that. I mean, like the edges were rounded. It looks like something you would like buy from an expert at a crafts fair or something. So
this is a good point. I mean, this town has lost a treasure of an artist.
Yes. The biggest whittler in the town is really gone. I mean, who knew that Ennis was both a prolific writer, but also a great carver as well. You know, he might as well be the Ron Swanson of this town, even though we did have Nick Offerman appear at the show at one point in time.
Yes, actually, that's a very, very good point. So I think that this town has really lost something. Now we're talking through this. I didn't even realize he's the Michelangelo of the town of this small town. I think this is a really real tragic loss. Now I'm even more upset about this death. Damn it, Mike.
I know. But
this is really upsetting.
Like you said, life happens. We must move on. But, I mean, this is probably one of the big hanging threads coming out of this first episode. And I think a lot of viewers have big questions about it. I know that we got a question specifically from Today Has Been Rough on Twitter about it. These two books, so as you mentioned, they are fictional, but they're locked up in a lockbox underneath the floor upstairs in Enos's house. One is called The Dungeon Lurk, which has a picture of what looks like a girl running away from sort of like Cthulhu-looking figure. And the other one is Planet Whim, which, as Gloria displays, the characters on the cover are in the same positions as the carving that he made. So do you have any initial theories as to why Ennis has these books and whether or not they're linked to him specifically?
Well, unfortunately, I do not. I mean, I was wanting to really do a little bit more research on this and see what other people were saying, and I did not get that opportunity to do that over the last, 12 or 14, 24 hours since the last time, since I watched this episode. So I haven't had a chance to really put some thought to it. So hopefully you did, because at this point right now, I think I really need to see more to have an idea of maybe what the significance of this, because obviously there is definitely a huge significance of it. And I don't know if it's going to, what it's exactly is going to lead to, but what do you think? Where did you have some thoughts then, my friend?
I indeed do. So if you notice, when Gloria walked in and she heard that aforementioned creaking in the upstairs floor, she picked up something. Do you remember what she picked up?
Oh, no. I do not remember what she picked up. What did she pick up?
She picked up this, what looked to be a statue of a rocket on a pedestal. And if you know what a Hugo Award is, Jeremiah, a Hugo Award is an award that's given to prolific writers of science fiction. And the Hugo Award happens to look like a rocket on a pedestal. So again, total Mike Bloom trademark, picking one small detail and basing an entire theory about it. I believe that Ennis is a sci-fi writer who might have settled down and retired and decided to, you know, do away with the writing lifestyle and just become, you know, a clerk at the old Red Mart. But maybe the two books hidden away, maybe they were lost manuscripts, maybe they were books that held a significance to him. I'm not entirely sure why they exist in a lockbox underneath the floorboards, but I think that Ennis, whether Gloria knows why or not, is a sci-fi writer in some regard.
Okay, I like this. This makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm buying this. So this is the Mike Bloom hot take for Fargo season 3.
I'm glad that carried over from the Leftovers podcast.
Yeah, I figured why not, right? But
this. That would probably be my. I'm merging that with Jack's crackpot theory as well. I'll co-opt that phrase for this podcast.
Yes, and it's very fitting. I mean, we are on the Jay and Jack Network, and we might as well, right? Of course. Yeah. But I like this very much, and the science fiction writer, this is great. I could definitely buy this, and it makes a lot of sense. So we'll see. I'm sure that's not I feel like it's definitely something that's going to get answered. I don't know right away if it's going to get answered in the next episode, but it's going to get answered very quickly, and we will definitely be finding out a little bit more of Enos's secrets, shall we say, in his former life as a young person maybe or whatever. But very fascinating. And then how will it tie into the season? That is to be remain to see. But what I think that there's going to, I'm sure, be a great tie-in, and it's going to be hopefully has a great payoff, right? That's what we can hope for.
You would hope so. Hopefully this does not turn into a season 2 finale. Hey, the alien language that Ted Danson's character was writing was just him trying to come up with a way for all of us to communicate.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. But yeah, let's hope it's not that.
I'm putting it open there.
Yeah, especially too, since there is a science fiction realm to this story we're talking for this the theory we have going on. So, oh boy, well, we'll see. oh boy, the next. Then we lead into the big climax. Of course, is we get back, we see, of course, Ray and Nikki are coming back from the Wildcats Regionals. They finished third, apparently. They're very excited, right? They're ready to party hardy. By party hardy, I mean they go back to her place, and they, of course, are having some romantic time in the bathtub to only get an unwelcome interruption by Maurice. This whole scene, of course, in the restroom, in the bathroom, was so great. I mean, she's like, why is there a man in my bathroom? And he's like, let's not jump to conclusions here, hon.
Yeah, it's just this was, again, a fantastic comedic scene. I mean, Maurice is totally out of it. He just sort of storms in and just starts monologuing. He doesn't even notice that there are two people just naked in the bathtub. He'll become very enveloped by the nudity later on, but he's clearly off in his own world. Nikki's trying to get an explanation out of Ray. Ray's just like, oh, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And clearly Ray's trying to get information out of him. And then the big misunderstanding comes out. The one thing I really like about Fargo as well is that the violence in the show is not smooth. You know, you're not going to get, like, any sort of John Wick stylings out of even Lorne Malvo,
of course,
who might
right.
be the most crafty gunsman of them all. So when you have this thing where Maurice ends up holding Ray at gunpoint after, you know, Ray kind of sends him into a rage. You have Nikki try to go with this plan of like, oh, I'm going to stand up and distract him. But both of them are distracted, and Nikki has to vocalize like, Ray, get the gun. And when Ray tries to get the gun, he shows up, of course, what a wimp he is, and that he's not even able to grab a gun from a pothead. That's pretty weak, Ray. So I just love how sloppy things are. It makes it slightly more realistic in that regard.
That's actually a good point. It did feel very realistic. Like, I could totally see this playing out in real life. And that's what I do like about the show, because there is a more realistic aspect to most of these scenes, because the little bit we've already know about Ray and Nikki, it made a lot more sense that she'd be sharp on her toes, had this great plan. Ray screws it up completely, right? And then she has to, of course, eventually save the day in the end. But I thought it was very, very realistic. I do. This is a really great point. And I didn't think I was going to be seeing Ewan McGregor's and Mary Elizabeth Winstead's asses, but I'm okay with that. I mean, were you okay with this? I mean
definitely.
It's always nice to have a good ass scene somewhere in any show when you're watching, right?
Well, one of them. I would say that I think Ewan McGregor showed his commitment, at least, in putting on the weight to look as schlubby as Ray does. So probably not the most ideal Ewan McGregor butt I would like to look at least like the I would rather see the Emmett butt than the Ray butt at this point, but maybe the Ray butt is sort of a gateway. Hopefully in seeing one brother's butt, we get to see the other one eventually. It's only equal.
Of course. It's only fair. It's really only fair. So we talked a little bit about it. This plan she comes up with that, like you say, calculated so well, where she had even counting the steps of what she thought roughly would how much time she had before he would get to the bottom. Luckily for her, he was high off his kite again, of course, like we said earlier, and was took his sweet ass time getting down the stairs. So he even gave her more time to buy to set up this perfect murder. So I was very impressed right off the bat from this. I thought she really impressed me. What did you think about this? This was really a great scene. I know we already talked quite a bit about it, you know, the significance of it, and of course the dramatic moment of his looking like he really got smashed by a boulder the size of a car. But it was great, right? I mean, it was really entertaining to watch.
It was fun. I just question. I don't know. There was something about the pacing of the suspense for it that was a little off to me. For example, you have, as you said, okay, Nikki calculating to the second him coming out. But then why did she have to have Ray look outside to tell her where he was? Don't you think it would have been more dramatic if she yells, like, now, and then you have Ray once again slow-mo drop kicking that air conditioner out of the window and it lands on him? I feel like that might have been more effective than having add that extra step. It sort of threw things out of rhythm to be like, all right, I got to calculate it to the exact point, but just to make sure, you look out the window and check to make sure he's there. That being said, it did not make the ending any less impactful. That's definitely a word of choice considering what the literal impact of it was.
But there was a real impact.
Yeah, but I would say the rhythm of that sequence felt a little off to me in that regard.
Yeah. No, that's actually a good point. I mean, I didn't put a lot of thought to it because, you know, it sort of made sense that she, because I'm trying to remember. So she's working it out, and he comes in and she says, you know, to go to the window to look to see. I don't know if maybe it was just her way of like keeping him distracted while she's trying to do what she's got to do. But yeah, you're right. It just kind of messed up the flow a little bit. What did you think about having the whole 360 aerial camera view of the, you know, as the air conditioning, you know, falls to this poor man's head? Did you like the way they did that artistically?
Oh yeah, I love the AC POV. That was so much fun to just watch it slowly rotating. I kind of wish that they had committed to it and done it the entire way down. I understand, again, that impactful shot of cutting out from it from the front point of view, but I thought it would be really fun to just follow that air conditioner the entire time, though maybe they did that initially and some complained that it made them feel too dizzy. You know, we don't want a Blair Witch Project scenario coming out of Fargo episode one, but I thought it was very unique.
Yeah, I think so. I that would have maybe been a nice little element to get done that. Maybe they tried it and it didn't work right, like you said. So it makes a lot of sense. But I think that it goes without saying that so much of this was done sloppy. I know they feel like maybe they maybe covered their tracks there, but I mean, we all know that not only Maurice, of course, had left so many trails. I saw some people on Reddit later this afternoon talking about this, like the trail that he leaves behind leading up to the fact that they're going to find out, you know, that Maurice was involved in this murder and stuff. So it's going to get back to them. I mean, this is not going to go well for them, but I thought it was interesting that they made a point that she said, hey, make sure that you burn the stamps. Do you think that Ray's smart enough to remember to burn them? I mean, that was there for a reason as well. I'm sure he's not going to, right?
I think he's going to burn the stamps, but I think the crux of the investigation is going to lie with, if you remember, one of the other reasons why Maurice was delayed getting downstairs is because he tore his shirt on the banister. I feel like, you know, Nikki's going to have this story of like, oh yeah, he was just walking under this around the sidewalk. The air conditioner fell out of our window and fell on top of him. Poor guy. Then they're going to have some links to Ray, but it won't be that, you know, that cogent. But then they're going to find like a scrap of his shirt on the banister, and they're going to start making assumptions that he met with them eventually. I think that's going to be the thing that really starts to have their regime topple a bit.
Yeah, they definitely showed that for a reason. And that was one of the many things that I thought of, too, that was just so much that he left behind that it's going to get back to them for sure. So you're thinking he does go ahead and burn the stamps and that it's going to be so many other things that leads them to them being involved.
And what I will say is I think that one of the reasons why they will burn the stamps is because that will then muddle the investigation to drag it out for a couple of episodes, because then they could say, like, why did this man invade Ennis's house? What were they after? And it might lead them down a false trail, like with the sci-fi novels, for example. Whereas if they found the stamps, they would say, okay, this is what he was after. You know, case closed in a way. This definitely opens up more possibilities in the investigatory process.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's inevitable. We know that they're going to get caught. So it'll be interesting to see how that all, of course, all plays out. And it makes me wonder. I mean, so that's definitely going to be the crust of what's going to happen. So I have no idea. Does Ray, is he give up on the whole stamp thing at this point? Or do you think he is not still done with this? Is he going to try to get the stamp himself? Are we done with, I mean, we can't be done with Ray wanting some kind of something from his brother, from this stamp, right? He still goes after the stamp, right?
That's tough, though, because Ray is essentially, I mean, Nikki's kind of put him on the run at this point. Do you think he's going to try to immediately retreat back to his brother? Maybe in the initial stages, but Emmett has his own stuff to deal with that he probably won't take him in, especially considering the circumstances of their last conversation. So I feel like we're going to have the brothers actually separated for a good while. I do still feel like the stamp is going to be the reason why their conflict exists, but I don't know if it's necessarily still about the stamp at this point. I think Ray now has many more things to fear about in his life than trying to get that damn stamp back.
Yeah, I know, and that's why I was kind of thinking, you know, because so much of this is set up because of the stamp. I was thinking, wow, I guess we'll be done with the stamp because he's going to have way too much going on to be worried about it. So I don't know. Well, we know that things are still not settled as far as the brother. There's going to be interactions between these two, and it will be interesting to see where the writers are going to lead us to with that. And we do have a final scene, of course, where we see Gloria's son Nathan's father comes to pick him up to get him out of there, because obviously she's got a lot of work to do. So that sets up that stage where she's going to try to figure out, of course, what happened. That's pretty much the end of the episode, and I don't know what else we can say about necessarily that scene or anything, but what was your takeaways? Anything that what are we missing here? Anything that's big that we should really put our heads together and talk about that might lead into the next episode, or do you think we covered everything pretty good? What do you think, Mike?
I think we got everything covered pretty good for now, because you and I have one more big thing to get to, Jeremiah, that I'm very excited to do with you.
Yes, absolutely. I'm excited too. Do you want to go ahead and set this up?
Sure. So for those of you that may have followed Jeremiah when he covered Fargo Season 2 over on Post Show Recaps, him and Josh Wegler and Antonio Mazzaro did what they called a death draft, where after the first episode of the season, they picked a few characters from the main lineup that they felt like are going to die by the end of the season, since Fargo is a show that tends to sort of gun down nearly all of its main characters by the end of every season, really clean house in that regard. Jeremiah and I are going to do things a little differently here. Because Fargo can also be such a violent show as well, if this episode is any indicator, we're still going to do a death draft. Essentially, what we're going to each do for the sake of time is each pick only two characters between us. How this is going to work is if one of our picked characters dies by the end of the season, we won't count this first episode. So, you know, you can't pick Ennis, you can't pick Maurice, everyone else is on the table. If you pick that character and that character dies by the end of the season, you will get, let's say, 2 points. However,
yes,
if one of the characters that you pick kills someone over the course of the season, whether accidentally or on purpose, they will get 1 point per kill. So in a little bit of a deviation from what you usually do, Jeremiah, we will not only be drafting for people that we think will die simultaneously, maybe we'll try to draft someone who we think will die but might also take some people, you know, on the way down as they eventually, you know, strap off that mortal coil.
Yeah, I like this idea too, because it's going to tempt one of us to maybe consider drafting someone like Karen Kuhn's character Gloria, who probably is not going to die, but she probably might be involved in killing some people. So, you know, it's a temptation, you know, other than just taking someone who you know is up to no good and probably will either die or also be involved in killing people. So I like this because, you know, it's a point system now. So the best man wins with the most points. And did we determine who's going to go first, though, in this draft? Because I don't know if I remember our Mike conversations if we discuss who's getting the first pick of the draft. Because I'm willing to give it to you.
No, I'll be the dummy. I'll let you pick. You've been leading this podcast and moving us along very well in this conversation. So you do the honor. You get first pick off the board for the death draft here for Fargo Season 3.
Wow. Well, that is very kind of you, sir. If we ever play bridge together, I'll make you help you win. I don't know.
We'll be on the same team, so I hope so.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Never mind. Forget that. Yes, that's very kind of you. I think it would be very foolish not to take VM Varga. I think that, you know, he's going to be involved in a lot of chaos, I think, at some point. So I feel like he's the guy that you'd want. It's either that or one of the Stussy brothers. Is it pronounced Stussy? What do we decide? Did they say it in the episode?
Stussy. Yeah, there's no umlaut over the U, so I don't know if it's Stussy. I've been going with Stussy for now. I believe that's how they pronounced it, too.
I think that's how they pronounced it. But anyway, so it was between one of the brothers or V&M. I'm going to go with VM Varga. That's who I'm going to go with for the first pick here in our Def Draft. So you're up, my friend.
All right. I am going to go with one of the Stussy brothers. And actually, there's some interesting parallels drawn between Nikki and Ray with the couple from Season 2. With Ed and Peggy. And I feel like there are similar parallels in that both Peggy and Nikki seem to be the ones that are a little more conniving, have a little bit more of a straight head. And Peggy got some blood on her hands, but I feel like Ed was the one that was really getting involved in a lot of the violence going on, which eventually resulted in the end of his own life. So I am going to, with my number one pick, I'm going to pick Ray. I think I'm hedging my bets here in that I do think he's going to die eventually. He's going to become a victim of Nikki's machinations. At the same time, I do feel like he might be able to take out some people on the way out. I will not count what he did to Maurice as something just to sort of wipe the slate clean and not give myself an inherent advantage to start, but that's going to be my pick.
I like this. I mean, if I was in your shoes, that's probably who I would go with in the end. I mean, it's tempting to maybe consider Emmett, but I think Ray is the best pick between the two brothers. And I mean, he seems to be the more tragic story, so I feel like I will be shocked if one of these brothers do live at the end of the season, and it's Ray. I would really be surprised. I really would be surprised. Huh?
Do you have a second pick there, Jeremiah?
Yeah, so I'm gonna go with and this kind of goes with your saying about who has the most prowl to maybe do something bad. I'm going to go with Nikki here for my second pick. I think that makes the most sense at this stage of the game. And for you, who do you want for your last choice?
So I'm probably going to pick someone here who, again, is rather innocuous to everything. I feel like he's definitely going to die. I have no idea if he's going to kill anyone on the way out. Give me Sai. I feel like Sai is close enough to the action that's going on with Emmett, but at the same time is not as important enough of a character to be able to survive this skirmish. I feel like if and when the Stussy company falls out of line, Varga's going to look to Sai first as someone expendable to take out. Mm-hmm. So I feel like Sai personally is not long for this world.
Yeah, I was eyeing him too. I think this is a very wise choice. So we have, this is a good draft, my friend. It'll be interesting to see who comes out on top in the end. But very good, sir. Thank you. And thank you for letting me pick first. That's so kind of you.
Of course. And in true Fargo fashion, I was very polite and let you go ahead of me.
Exactly. That's great. Well, I think for the most part, like we said earlier, we definitely covered everything very, very well. I'm looking forward, of course, Mike, till next week till we get to see another episode to break down. Of course, this one went a little lengthy, but it was a very long episode. Not quite sure what the length of time is for the second episode, but I'm sure it's probably going to be a lot shorter than this one, probably more closer back to the 60-minute normal episode that we're going to be used to for most of the season outside of maybe the finale. So, we went a little lengthy this time, but I'm sure maybe next time will be a little shorter. But I had a really good time, of course, breaking this down with you, my friend. Like I said, it was a lot of fun. And Mike, why don't you go ahead and share with people how they can get a hold of you? Where would be the best place on the internet webs to contact you to talk a little Fargo love?
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at a Mike Bloom type. I talk about Fargo and a bunch of other TV shows. If you want to listen to other podcasts, I do immediately on the Jay and Jack Network as well. As mentioned before, I cover The Leftovers with the eponymous Jay and Jack. We actually just released our premiere, season three premiere podcast earlier on this week. As Jeremiah said, it was a really good episode. I had a lot of fun getting to hop on the podcast and talk with them about that. You can check out that in the Jay and Jack whole enchilada feed. And make sure you're subscribed to that to check out all the other great stuff Jay and Jack are doing. Survivor, the broadcast, the Married Men cast, Game of Thrones will be coming back in a couple months as well. So there's always stuff going on the Jay and Jack network. And also make sure you're subscribed to the Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike feed as well. Just find us on iTunes. And if you want to leave us a rating and review, of course, that's greatly appreciated. We're grateful for the couple of pieces of feedback in terms of questions that we've received so far before this podcast. We would love as much feedback as possible on this episode before we record. You can either tweet to us or you can email us at fargowithmj@gmail.com. I pulled a Maurice during our preview podcast and actually gave the wrong email address. So again, that's fargowithmj@gmail.com. And yeah, like you said, Jeremiah, I think it was a strong episode. Really want to talk with you about it. And I'm excited to see where these threads are going to lead in the coming weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can hit me up on Twitter, of course, at @jpanhorst. I, of course, love to talk all things Fargo and television in general. That's pretty much what I do on Twitter, is talk about television and occasionally film and stuff. But that's my favorite topic, is definitely TV. And we will definitely be back next week. So we'll be looking for that in your feed. Like you said, we do appreciate those. Like you, Mike had pointed out, ratings, the star ratings, and so a little bit of feedback. We would love to hear what you guys think, how we're doing, what we can improve on, and all those wonderful things. So thanks for joining us, and Mike, and until next week, my friend, you have a good one, okay?
You too.